Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of your existence, the bliss of growth, the glory of action, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today well lived makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. It is good to be together again. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. We come to the center of our service, and we want to bring this down and make room for the silences in our lives when you can light candles of memory and hope or just sit quietly and remember who you are and why you're here. Blessed are the hungry, for they shall be filled.
Joe is somewhere on the road.
Blessed are those who weep, for they shall laugh.
We lost Davy in the Korean War.
Blessed are you when men shall hate you.
I still don't know what for.
And when they shall separate you from
your country. Don't matter anymore.
Do unto others as you would have them.
You know that old trees just grow strong.
Given unto
waiting
you.
For someone to say hello in there, hello.
Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy.
Me and my husband, we don't talk much anymore.
Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God.
He sits and stares through the back door screen.
Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God.
And all the news just repeats itself.
And be merciful.
Like some forgotten dream.
As God is merciful.
That we both sing.
Amen.
Someday I'll go and call up Judy. We worked together at the factory. Ah, but what would I say when she asks what's new? Say nothing, what's with you? Nothing much to do. You know that old trees just grow stronger and old rivers grow wilder every day. Oh, but old people, they just grow lonesome waiting for someone to say hello. Down the street sometime, and you should spot some hollow ancient eyes. Don't as if you didn't care. Say hello in there.
I'm sure you recognize the words that I said in counterpoint with Bette Midler's song, Hello in There. They were taken from the Beatitudes in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Many people who know the Beatitudes don't know that there are two different versions of them and that they're quite different. The version most of us know comes from the Gospel of Matthew. It's a very spiritualized version. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. This is the kind of message most people come to church for. Heck, we're all poor in spirit. We all mourn, and we often come to church hoping to hear something that'll make us feel better. Almost nobody comes to church hoping to hear something that'll make them feel worse. I've noticed this. So it's comforting to be told that everything will turn out all right for those who are poor in spirit and those who mourn. But the earlier and the more authentic version of the Beatitudes comes from the Gospel of Luke. And rather than being so spiritual, they're very concrete and very down to earth, and much closer to what biblical scholars think fits the rest of Jesus' message. They say things like, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are the hungry, for they shall be filled. Blessed are you when men shall hate you, and when they shall separate you from their company. Even though I'm not a Christian, I have always liked Jesus' sayings, partly because many of them are so profound, and partly because they can make us so uncomfortable. Churches are funny places. They're so polite. They're well-dressed, refined places compared to the streets. Sermons are always rated G. Even war stories like last week's wouldn't be rated any worse than PG. You see much worse stuff in the movies. Even your six-year-olds can. We gather here with our kind of people, and that's part of the attraction. We gather with people who mostly look like us, think like us. They're probably educated or overeducated, like us. They're clean. They dress well. They don't embarrass us by coming up to us during coffee hour. Beth, once, only once. Give it a rest. Sometimes you start these things and their own spirits take over. I feel like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and I've released spirits I can't control. So our kind of people don't come up to us in coffee hour begging for spare change, and they don't smell. Sure, they may be spiritually hungry or homeless, but they all eat regularly and have a warm place to live. Things aren't so neat with people who are really poor, hungry, and homeless. They aren't always fed. They don't always see justice. They can't always find a warm or a safe place to lay their heads. Their clothes are usually dirty, and they often smell. They're not our kind of people. They're not much like the people who gather at any church. And when we think of giving some spare change to them, don't we usually do it kind of furtively, seldom meeting their eyes? We do it because they make us feel guilty, or because it makes us feel a little better but it's almost never anything you would call a spiritual experience. Jesus sided with the homeless, but then Jesus was homeless himself. He had no job, no place to lay his head, no money. So of course he would side with the homeless. He was one of them. Christianity has always had this double message about both spiritual hunger and real physical hunger and homelessness. So have almost all other religions. In some of our worst inner cities, and this was something I was much closer to when I lived in the north, near Detroit and in Chicago, the black Muslims became well known for their work on the streets among the poor and the hungry and the homeless and the desperate. It wasn't spiritual hunger they were filling, or at least it wasn't only spiritual hunger. Hinduism probably has the most spiritual of all God images. If you've seen some of the Hindu depictions of gods, they're wild. Some have four arms, the head of an elephant. They're things that no one could take literally. They're purely spiritual. And yet, right here in Austin, many people don't know that we have the largest Hindu temple in North America. Barsana Dham, south of town, where a lot of us will be next Sunday, they're hosting the annual Austin Area Interreligious Ministries Thanksgiving service that some of us will be a part of. And as anyone who's been there knows, among the most dramatic and impressive things in that whole very impressive compound are their two huge commercial kitchens with cooking pots over 3 feet in diameter that can cook more than 50 gallons of food at a time. They routinely feed 2,000 to 3,000 people there, real down-to-earth food, not just spiritual food, good, delicious, vegetarian food. So again, the religion feeds both the body and the soul. And some Buddhists have taken this physical care for other life more seriously than probably any of us would want to take it. Since they believe that all life is linked, that all living creatures were once humans in another lifetime, some Buddhist monks are carried through the streets lying in beds filled with bed bugs, and they collect money for food. But the food is the monk whose sacred duty is to feed the bed bugs. All right, now that's going too far. I couldn't be a Buddhist monk in that order. I don't like bed bugs. Still, all religions teach about caring both for the spirit and for the body. Now I want to take this somewhere unexpected. So far, I think all of these teachings, while true, are pretty superficial. They're about duties that we owe to the less fortunate. And frankly, while I agree with them, the arguments never moved me very much. I think they're true, but not very compelling. And I don't think they're particularly religious, though I think they're ethical. When I'm being brutally honest, I have to admit, I don't feel much kinship to beggars. I've worked hard, I have a job, and I don't always understand why they're there. Intellectually, I can cite statistics of layoffs and unemployment rates and so on, but I don't feel I'm one with them. On any given day, about 300,000 of those homeless people are Vietnam veterans. I have some feeling for their pain because it's a pain I've felt myself. But it's been 30 years. Something in me feels great sympathy for them, and something in me wants to say, get on with it. Now, I'm speaking only for myself, not for you. But if you look at all of our actions, I'm betting they show that we look at helping the homeless as a charitable act we would do, in which they really couldn't offer anything in return. It's a condescending kind of charity, no matter how important and necessary it is. Where we do all the giving, they do all the receiving, and we get to feel virtuous. As long as we see it as just a matter of economics or exchange, I think it can be ethical, but I don't think it's very spiritual. So I want to go to a different level. I want to go to a different dimension of this idea of interactions between our kind of people and not our kind of people, between fortunate and unfortunate, dimensions that I think are profoundly spiritual. Whenever we deal with stories about spiritual transformation in almost all the world's religions and myths and fairy tales, we're almost always talking in magical and supernatural language. As a matter of fact, magical and supernatural language in religious stories and fairy tales is usually the clue that we're talking about some form of spiritual transformation. It seems to be that this subject is just something that goes beyond the reach of our ordinary language. So I'll tell you some stories about this. One is about a man who was approached by a mysterious stranger and told that if he would be charitable to the gods that he met on the way home, he would be rewarded with a great treasure. The man had absolutely no idea what this meant. The stranger gave him 5 hats, absolutely gorgeous brand new hats. And he said, carry these hats with you. And he said, when you see gods, cover their heads with the hats, and a great treasure will await you. So the man's going home, carrying 5 hats and looking at them, and more than once he thought about switching one of them with his own hat, which was very old and tattered, and decided not to. And he looked everywhere on the way home, everywhere, in every alley, in every doorway, up in trees. He didn't see anything, and he certainly didn't see any gods, although he wasn't quite sure what he was looking for. And he got all the way home and had never found any. And then sitting right in front of his house were 6 filthy beggars. And again, he looked around for gods, and there weren't any, and he thought about it for a second, and then said to the beggars, well, I'm all the way home, and I didn't find any gods, so you might as well have these, because it was cold and their heads were bare. So he took the 5 new hats, and he put them on 5 of the beggars, and then the 6th beggar looked at him, and he thought, I can't stop here, so he took his own hat off and put it on the 6th beggar, and went home and went inside. When he got inside, he found that his whole home had been transformed into a mansion, with marble and gold and bags of gold everywhere. And he looked out his front window, which was now a much bigger window than it had been before, and he saw 6 beggars begin to glow with a kind of golden glow and then rise up to their home in heaven. They'd only looked like beggars. Down deep, they were sacred. Here's another story. A certain Jewish synagogue had fallen on hard times. They were down to only about 13 members. No new people were coming, and the old members just picked and griped at each other, each of them blaming the others for the fact that they were so small and they were on the verge of dying. They sensed at some level that this was probably God's punishment for some sin. And if they could have found out which one of them was the sinner, they would have run him out on a rail. When they heard a famous rabbi was coming to town, they sent their leader to talk to the rabbi. And the man went and he explained the whole story to the visiting rabbi. And the rabbi began nodding before he'd even finished the story. The rabbi said, yes, yes. He said, you are being punished for a sin. You are. He said, It's the sin of ignorance. You see, one of you is the Messiah, and you don't know it. The old Jew walked back to his community completely puzzled. And when he told the rest what the rabbi had said, they were all puzzled. The Messiah here among us? How could this be? Who could it be? They all wondered silently. Surely it can't be this one. He was nasty. This one over here is selfish, and that one's rude, and the rest of them are just so ordinary. Still, the rabbi said it was one of them, and they obviously couldn't tell which one it was. Gradually, they began treating each other kindly, just in case. Rather than blaming, they began offering to help. Before long, the word got out in the community that there was a synagogue in town where everyone who came was treated as though they might be the Messiah. Soon they had more members than they knew what to do with. The place was bursting at the seams, and they built a new synagogue dedicated to the belief that the Messiah was always among them, so they should treat everyone as though it might be them. The message of these stories, and this is the other dimension, the message of these stories is that when we look at people and see the holy in them, instead of just seeing their failings, it can transform both them and us. Look at how many fairy tales there are with this plot. The princess kisses a frog and he turns into the prince of her dreams. Is that really how it happened? Or was she just able to see that he was already a prince who felt like a frog and needed a kiss to awaken? Beauty performs the same miracle with the beast, and probably in the same way. He never really was a beast. People just hadn't known how to look at him through the eyes of love. The ugliest duckling becomes the swan. Cinderella becomes the princess. Beggars turn out to be incarnations of God. And the miracle happens, I'm convinced, when we can look into another's eyes, see into their soul, their spirit, and say, "Hello in there." Jesus once said, "Whatever you do to the least of these, you do also to me." It's the same story. Treat them like dirt, and we betray the fact that our religious vision cannot see beyond our kind of people. Treat them like children of God. They feel more like our own brothers and sisters, and we realize that, my God, we're all in the same family. We really are all in this together. This is the season of the year when we start providing dinner and a warm place to sleep and breakfast for about 50 adult homeless people here on nights when the temperature is close to freezing. The woman who works at the Austin Resource Center for the Homeless that coordinates the freeze nights told me that her people really like coming to the churches. "Why?" I asked. "Our floors are hard and we don't have cots." "No," she said, "but in the churches, people talk to them. They're so hungry to be spoken to be treated like people." What she's saying is that more than almost anything, almost more than food, they wish someone would meet their eyes and say, "Hello in there." When that can happen, at a very human level, suddenly they become our kind of people, which in truth, they always have been. We're hosting a panel here tomorrow night, here on this stage, a panel called Faces of Homelessness, made up of present or former homeless people from Austin. Come hear them. See if you don't feel that these people are more like us than not. They bleed when they're cut, they shiver when they're cold, they cry when they're hurt, and they hurt when they're sloughed off as though they weren't people at all, but only dirty things that clutter up our streets. Most stories about things like this, I've noticed. I'm trying to become more aware of my own limits and biases. Most of the stories we read and the stories I've read you so far, told you so far today, could be called socialist stories or Democrats' stories, right? About giving donations to the poor. And I was delighted this week to find a Republican story with a very different twist on it that helps make the picture more complete. This comes from the Hindu, Rabindranath Tagore, from his first book, Gitanjali. See how it twists. I had gone begging from door to door in the village path when your golden chariot appeared in the distance like a gorgeous dream, and I wondered, who was this king of all kings? My hopes rose high, and I thought my bad days were at an end, and I stood waiting for alms to be given unasked, and for wealth scattered on all sides in the dust. The chariot stopped where I stood. Your glance fell on me, and you came down with a smile. I felt that the luck of my life had come at last. Then you held out your right hand and said, "What do you have to give me?" Ah, what a joke it was to open your palm to a beggar to beg. I was confused and I stood undecided, and then from my bag I slowly took out the least little grain of corn and gave it to you. But how surprised I was when at the day's end I emptied my bag on the floor to find a least little grain of gold among the corn. I bitterly wept and wished that I had had the heart to give you my all. I think if we look at charity only as something we give to lesser people, there's something demeaning about it. There's something condescending about it. I think that what's involved is seeing people as brothers and sisters, which means we offer not only compassion, but also challenge and opportunity. That's what makes them parts of the human community. Being respected as people and held to the same kinds of standards others are. What we haven't found a way to do in our society is provide the structures where their efforts could make a difference. When we have homeless people who are working full-time and still cannot afford a home, the laws are set up wrong. But it has to go both ways. What's needed is to treat them like humans, not like charity cases. What would happen to our society if we began to believe these people, homeless in Austin, really were our brothers and sisters? What kinds of laws would we then fight to change? What kind of safety nets would we work to create? What kind of training and empowerment programs would we set up so that they can find meaningful work? Even the most fortunate of us, if you think about it, is little more than one serious brain injury or a few financial disasters away from being on the streets. We don't think it could happen to us, but once, they didn't think it could happen to them either. What happens to us when we stop seeing these poor, hungry, and homeless people as things and see them as incarnations of God? What's the treasure that both religious myths and children's fairy tales say can come to us when we treat them as though they might really be incarnations of beauty, of worth, of the gods? Something in us looks into them. Something in them looks into us, and we say, "Hello in there. Hello, I recognize you. You're like me. I know your hopes and dreams and your fears because I have them too. Hello in there, my brother, my sister. Hello." One thing I'm sure of is that once we see how much alike we are, how much we really are all sisters and brothers, that it can change our world. We can easily let subhuman strangers live lives of desperate danger, but we can't as easily let it happen to those to whom we have said, "Hello in there." Because when that happens, we feel that we didn't encounter a beggar after all. We encountered something holy. We encountered an essence of life that we recognize in ourselves too. We encountered God. And then the homeless people are no longer the dregs of life. They're the essence of life. And they are our kind of people. We know our souls came from the same stuff, are woven from the same fabric of hopes, yearnings, and fears, that we're all trying to find ourselves a home in this world. In a spiritual sense, we become homeless together, as children alone in the world with only ourselves and each other to count on. You may wonder how this could really change the world. I think the truth is that it's the only thing that can.